That's Shovels and Rope, their song called Oh Be Joyful. And that is our hope for the rest of today, right? To enjoy the day, even though it's time for layers and fleece-lined tights. If you're like me, I'm Heidi Holton with John Bauer. I guess it's a little bit personal. Are you wearing fleece-lined tights?
No, very seldom, maybe like four times a year.
Oh, good for you.
Well.
Yeah. You got to stay warm, right?
My dad wore them in July, so
fleece-lined tights.
Well,
you're
just
talking
long. You wear long underwear, long neckers. Yeah, I'd wear them in the July. You know, when
I wonder if see, you're the only person I've ever known that calls long johns long neckers. And my theory is it's because your name is John.
Oh, it could be.
And you didn't want to call them long johns.
No, I never thought about that, Heidi. Now I'm
right.
Now I'm thinking.
It's all because no one else on earth. Matt Geiger is our next guest. He has a new book out. It's called Astonishing Tales. I feel like he might know. Have you ever heard anyone call long johns long neckers, Matt?
I've never heard long neckers. Only know long johns.
Yeah, see, if they were called long mats, you would probably call them long neckers.
That's right. I love this deep dive into the etymology of this term. This is good.
It's obvious you got to get out more, Matt.
Not him.
Wait a minute now. Matt, what's your favorite Christmas cookie?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy. Oh, man. You're going with the controversial stuff right away.
Right away.
I would say I really like gingerbread cookies.
Kyle had ginger snaps. Gingerbread is a little bit different than a snap.
See, yeah. I always find gingerbread a little more decorative than tasty.
Yeah, just an ornament.
Mm. You can go in all sorts of directions with the decorative nature of them, with the shapes and things. And I guess I like that the abundance of forms that they allow for.
Oh, okay.
So if you had a right now were handed a gingerbread cookie, a gingerbread man, would you eat the foot or the head? Or they
would always decapitate it first.
There you do. You have to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, okay. So let me tell you a little bit about this new book out from Matt. It's called Astonishing Tales, Stories and Essays. And you see the little asterisk down there, John?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm asking you to read the asterisks.
Down here at the bottom?
No, below the lady's face. This is not going well.
Your astonishment may vary.
Sorry, Matt.
Your astonishment may vary. Now, I don't know who that is.
Well, we're going to find out, but stay tuned, John. So Matt lives in Wisconsin with his wife and his four-year-old, and we are very excited to talk to you today. Thanks for being here today, Matt.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. So we've been talking all morning because we are always really in awe of Santa Claus. You know, I mean, how hardworking he is, and he's everywhere. I mean, we don't know how he does it. And that's kind of, you know, you write about things in these essays that are kind of the everyday things or, you know, stuff that we've all kind of been through, but then you help us understand them a little bit more. And especially, you know, it's not like it's a book about parenting, but you find sort of the astonishment in it. And you've written about Santa Claus. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about bringing your daughter there, your pride in what she said to him, and kind of your affinity, natural affinity with Santa Claus.
Yeah, I do like that story very much. And Santa, Christmas pops up a couple times in the book, which I just realized actually when talking about it with various people. But that story, my weight fluctuates a lot. I live in the Midwest, right? So it's kind of seasonal, right? I pack on a bunch of weight in the winter and eat a bunch of cheese and things like that. And so I'm often round and jolly, relatively jolly, and I have a big beard and everything. And so I look like I'm 39, so hopefully a youthful Santa Claus at times. And I took my daughter, we take her to see Santa every year, and I took her 1 year. And all the kids line up and ask Santa for stuff. And when she got up there, she was really young, and she probably just didn't understand what was going on, but she just started listing off all the things she had that she really liked, her cat and her mom and her dad and her toys and things. And it was beautiful, primarily because parenting is kind of a competition, obviously, and all the other parents got to see what a good parent I was.
Yeah.
You know, look how wonderful my child is. But it did get me thinking about Santa and the idea of Santa, and myself in some ways, and all of us as the creatures and people that inhabit our mythologies that guide our lives. And in particular, because I had gained back a bunch of weight, I lost a bunch of weight, and, the doctor always says to do that, but then every single person I encountered who knew me became very upset because they all thought I was dying. Because when you lose 60 pounds, you just, it's kind of jarring. And so I kind of had this, I was like an emaciated, sallow-faced Santa Claus, I think is what I say in that story. So I decided just for it, not for my, I would sacrifice my own health to benefit all my friends, and I just gained back all the weight. So I looked right again.
What a guy.
Right. But all of that, and it goes in various directions, but does revolve around this idea of this figure who lives in a cold place and is nonetheless happy. You know, it's dark and cold. We all know where Santa lives. Although I heard my daughter the other night having a debate with one of her friends, and she said he lives in at the South Pole, and then her friend said he lives in Finland. So I don't know what's going on. But
well, you imagine how hard it was when you lost 60. Just imagine if Santa started counting points and stuff and he lost 60. The world would change.
It would be so off-putting, though, wouldn't it?
Oh, my gosh. Be horrible.
Well, it would be upsetting on several levels.
Well, I like how you write about, like I said, these sort of small things, this mythology that we don't even realize that we have there. And there's a quote right at the beginning or part of what you write. It says, it's what parenting is all about, the chance to teach someone how to use verbs and toilets while they teach you that most of the rules governing our lives are arbitrary and pointless. And for me, the best example of that is you and your daughter and Easter eggs, and you kind of examining the whole idea of Easter eggs. Tell us more about that story.
Yeah, that is kind of, there is a theme to all these stories that I tried to work on, and it was the weirdness of life and the beautiful strangeness that's all around us, but that you have to kind of go away from these ordinary things and come back to them from a slightly different angle to see it. And that story is a really kind of essential one, because I'm an idiot like everyone else, and we made Easter eggs, my daughter and I and my wife, one Easter. And a few days later, we have chickens in the backyard and everything, so we have lots of eggs, and we had leftover dye, and my daughter asked to make Easter eggs again. And I did that thing where I'm an adult, so I went like, oh, no, we can't. We're not allowed to. Like, not today. We have to wait another 360 days to do that. And then I realized, like, no, that's a completely arbitrary guideline. Like, we have time and we have the supplies, we can make Easter eggs now. And having a kid does kind of teach you how weird life is, and they also show you how many kind of missed opportunities for humor and mirth and fun slip by you when you're on autopilot as an adult, when you're just taking all the rules for granted. And that's, I like that story. That was originally appeared in the Sunlight Press. I should plug them. They're a wonderful online literary journal that I like very much.
So where did you get the Elizabeth Taylor kind of soft porn image on the front of the book?
That's my friend Bonnie, and she's 83.
Oh.
And she was at my book launch party with me the other night, actually, and she signed a bunch of books, too. And actually, it seemed people wanted her to sign the books more than they wanted me to. She is a wonderful example of, once again, this thing that the book is about. She is quote-unquote, a little old lady. And she walks around with a walker when she's getting up there in age, obviously. Someone pointed her out to me once and just said, you should ask her about her life. And I'm a writer and a journalist, and so, of course, I just ask people about their lives all the time. And we ended up, we had breakfast together, we had pancakes and coffee in a little cafe, and it went so long that we had to do it again, and then we became friends, and now we talk as frequently as possible. But when I first met her for coffee and breakfast, she showed up with this big plastic shopping bag, and it was full of photo albums. And in those photo albums, she had dozens, if not hundreds, of clippings from the 20 or so years that she was a massive pinup star in the 50s and 60s.
Whoa.
And burlesque performer and all these things. And she was a farm girl from Wisconsin, and when she was a teenager, she did the thing where she stood in the doorway and told her parents, you know, I'm leaving and I'm going to go be a big star and see my name in lights. And she did it. And the world in which she lived was not always fair. She faced, you know, brutality and misogyny and all these things that were and in many ways still are rampant. But she forged this beautiful, amazing, astonishing life. And that's what you get if you scratch the surface a little bit and look at people in a slightly different light or in a different way and ask them about their lives. And so that's why she's on the cover, and the picture is of her in, I think, 1961, I believe it is.
So this question has nothing with your book, but what'd you learn from her?
Well, I learned something real. I've learned a lot of things from her. The primary one is an idea that I really hope, and I'll bet every single parent out there, regardless of your ideologies that you embrace, agrees with this. I learned that it's possible to lead a good, fulfilling, meaningful life in a very imperfect world. Because I doubt, we all want to fix the world, but I seriously doubt, you know, our species has been around a long time, and I don't think it'll all be fixed by the time my daughter is 25 or any of your kids are grown up or whatever. But we still want them to lead good and meaningful lives, and that's what one of the many things she taught me.
Speaking with Matt Geiger, the name of the book is Astonishing Tales, Stories, and Essays. Now, just a few minutes ago, you were bragging about how marvelous your daughter was, or maybe you were bragging about how marvelous you are.
Right,
but
right,
I want to read a little bit just about the tantrum section. It says, I don't write about them often because, well, there are some things that you really can't put into words, like being blown away in a Category 5 hurricane or being mauled by a grizzly bear while learning your identity was stolen and your car caught in fire. You can go on and on about how unpleasant it is, but you really have to live through it to fully understand. Tell us about some of your daughter's tantrums.
Well, I adore my daughter, and as we all love our kids, I'm I'm certainly biased. But she has the first time they display anything, it's always so awesome, right? You're just amazed the first time they talk, and then a few years later, you're like, wow, they won't stop talking. This is amazing, and then her ability to weave a dramatic narrative, I thought was really cool the first time she did it. But she has a real ability it's wonderful because kids are, there's this idea that you don't really look at things in the middle of your life, right? You only really see things the first time you see it, and then sometimes the last time you see it, the last time you see a loved one's face or something. That's the only time you really look at it. And kids are seeing most things for the first time. And there's a certain drama that comes with that. There's this enormous meaning. She's encountering everything anew and really looking at it and not always understanding it. And I do think, all jokes aside, that's why kids throw such marvelous temper tantrums, because the world is just enormous. And if you're seeing everything for the first time, it's a lot, and sometimes it's overwhelming. And tantrums can be quite fun, assuming you survive them.
I never thought about that. We see things the first time and we see things the last time. We need to do more of that in between.
Right. Yeah, and you have to function, right? I mean, when I was in school, I studied philosophy, and you know, you learn very quickly that you don't look at the chair. If you're giving a talk or something, you should just ask people, don't look down, what's the chair you're sitting in look like? And no one knows, because out of the corner of your eye, you just see a chair-ish thing, and you plop down in it. But a kid really looks, because a kid doesn't know, they have to go like, what is that? Oh, that's a chair, right? You know, and this book is all about that perspective, and I talk in the book about my daughter got a hold of my cell phone and the camera on it one time without me knowing, and ran through the house taking pictures. And when I stumbled upon the pictures later, I didn't even know it was my own house because her perspective was so different. The way she saw things was so different.
Well, I have to say, I want to thank you for something. One of the essays I read of yours, I've always wondered if there was something wrong with me when I go to parties and people want to play these games.
Oh.
And I feel like I'm not the smartest person in the world. I'm not the funniest person in the world, but I'm okay. And it's I don't quite get it or want to, and tell us more about your feelings about it.
Oh, well, first of all, I like that story about party games. I slightly regret having it published in a book because I've clearly made myself a target now for big party game or whatever. But it is amazing to me, and I'm forced to play them all the time, and I don't know if this is just because I'm encroaching on middle age or what, but all our lives, all we complain about, no matter what our jobs are or what our lives are like, we're always complaining about, oh, there are all these arbitrary rules we have to follow. Oh, it's so exhausting. And then we all go gather in the evening and drink a bunch of wine and beer and sit around and read a long list of arbitrary rules that I never understand, by the way, and then have to follow them. And I never know. I can never tell who's winning or losing, and I don't understand. You know, these games befuddle me to no end. And you know, the person next to me, their answer, you'll have to write something down, and they'll write, you know, the color 7 or the number orange or something, and they'll get 20 points, and then I'll say, you know, the letter blue, and you know, people will laugh. You know, no, seriously, what's your answer, man? And I'm like, I don't know what's going on. So I really don't get it. But I think being confused is part of being alive, so I'm also okay with it. And I know that I have all my friends bring party games every time they come to my house now, because I have this story in the book about how much I detest them.
I think you need to embrace embrace that lack of knowledge, because I'm the exact same way. You know, just embrace it.
Yeah, I mean that is
it's who you are, for crying out loud. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the first step toward enlightenment, right? Is that you have to be Socrates. You have to admit that you don't know everything. And I don't know. I don't know. There are a lot of things I don't understand. I don't understand politics or, you know, any number of things. But I really don't understand party games. So I'm okay with it.
Matt, before we go, tell us a little bit about, like, the writers that inspired you. You know, you just mentioned Socrates. But are there contemporary writers that really kind of helped you in what you do?
Yeah, I feel an enormous mixture of feelings, contradictory feelings, whenever I read some of the writers I'm going to mention here, because I love them, and they make me laugh, and they make me so happy. They make me see the world in a better and funnier way. But I do burn with jealousy enormously whenever I read David Sedaris, and I think we're probably all can agree on that.
Right.
Catherine Newman, who wrote a couple books, but her Catastrophic Happiness it might be the funniest book I've ever read. It's about parenting, it's about life, it's about all these things, and she's amazing. And I, of course, I like Bill Bryson, and I like I like Michael Perry, mm-hmm. who lives in Wisconsin as well. And I like all sorts of writers. I was just reading an essay by Barbara Kingsolver, and it's not particularly funny, but it shakes your vision of the world. It's called Small Wonder, and it's about a 3-year-old boy who goes missing in the mountains of Iran, and they find him in a bear den with a living bear, and when they rescue him, he has the smell of bear milk on his lips. And it's just a story about how amazing the world can be at times. It's called Small Wonder.
We're talking with Matt Geiger. His new book, Astonishing Tales, Stories and Essays. You can find more information at geigerbooks.com. Matt, I just want to say that Grand Rapids is a timber, lumber, paper mill kind of town, and there are lumberjack competitions here. So I expect to see you at some point for your axe throwing prowess.
Yeah.
I'll be there showing off again, of course.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks for talking with us. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show.